Okay, Google. Listen. Eldon. That's right. Computers can't get saved, Eldon. They don't have a soul, right? But shoes can get saved because they have souls. Yeah. I know. It's a bad joke. Thanks. You're nice to laugh for me. Okay. All right. We're in 2 Kings chapter 4. Elisha has been performing some miracles, displaying God's power. They have sort of a double emphasis throughout this chapter because, on the one hand, these are all miracles that are performed to individuals, not to the nation. Not on a political or national scale to call the whole nation back, but to remind individuals of who God is. And so that's what chapter 4 is all going to contain. These miracles are not listed necessarily in chronological order. They're just simply listed as things that Elisha performed throughout his ministry. And there's very little connection between them other than that they are miracles. So we can't assume that these all happened one right after the other. These were probably scattered throughout Elisha's ministry. Well, the first one that we read about and we started into last week was the widow and her oil. The widow was the wife of one of the sons of the prophets, the school of prophets that Elijah started. Elisha probably had a big hand in helping start those schools as well. But her husband died, leaving massive amounts of debt, so much so that the creditor was coming to confiscate her only valuable possession, which was her sons, her two sons. And we said they're probably not even old enough to be heavy workers yet because they're not old enough to support her in her old age. And so we're probably talking about fairly young sons, but he's going to try to get his money's worth out of them. In God's law, in Leviticus and Exodus, it was granted that if you owed somebody money, you and your family would go serve them as household servants. But what was the limitation on that? The year of Jubilee, right. In the Jubilee, you'd be set free no matter how much of your debt you had paid off. If you managed to pay off the whole debt before then, that's great. You could go free. But the man was supposed to credit you at the standard worker's rate. You didn't serve him for free. So it's not like the slavery that we tend to think of where, you know, I'm just going to take Daniel, make him work for me forever, and he belongs to me. But I would take him into my home. I would give him food, I would provide his clothing and a place to stay, and he would work for me in exchange to pay off his debt. And I was supposed to pay him the standard going rate for a laborer, a fair wage. And so in that way, God provided that even people who had gotten into extreme financial hardship could work off their debt without leaving the creditor holding the bill either. Until the year of Jubilee. And then in the Jubilee, all debts canceled, everybody goes free, and they go back home. So that's what God prescribed in his law. But that doesn't mean that that's what northern Israel was practicing. We've got a lot of instances of the Israelites not doing what God told them to do. For instance, worshiping the idols, worshiping Baal, bringing Molech into Israel. They kicked out the Levites several kings ago. And they set up the golden calves. None of those things they were supposed to be doing, but they were doing it anyway. And so this woman's probably in a much worse state than we might imagine, because though God prescribed some limitations upon the servitude of these boys, the guy, the creditor, probably had no such intentions of limiting himself and what he was going to get back. He might have come to take them as slaves, and then they would have been his slaves forever. That's how the pagan nations practice their slavery. And so she comes to Elijah, presents the problem, and his solution was for her to do what? Tim? Mm-hmm. Right, so she's got this one little jar of oil, and I was doing a little bit of digging into this passage this week too and found out that word for jar of oil that she uses is the term for a flask of anointing oil. So we're talking about enough oil to pour on someone's head to anoint them when they're sick. not much oil, is it? We're not talking about the big bulk bottle of oil that you can buy from Costco or Sam's Club. You know, we buy olive oil in these huge containers. Of course, everything our family does is bigger. But we're talking about a little tiny jar of oil, just enough to anoint somebody. But Elisha says, borrow cans, borrow jars, borrow pots, anything you can pour oil into, and don't get a few of them. So she does. And she goes in her house. One boy hands her an empty jar. The other boy takes the one once it's filled up. And she fills up many, many, many jars. And she goes and sells the jars, not only pays her debt, but also has enough left over to live on. And we looked at that instance as a time when God was clearly communicating through his prophet Elijah that God cares about the average person. God is intimately involved in the affairs of our lives. He knows what's going on. If he knows the very hairs of our heads, and he knows when a sparrow falls, then he has to constantly reassure us, doesn't he, that we're of more value than many sparrows. And this woman and her sons were just as valuable to Jehovah as the entire nation of Israel. He was concerned about her, and he took care of her. Well, the rest of these miracles in chapter 4 are going to be somewhat along the same lines. God dealing with the average person, individuals. So, we also looked into the Shunammite woman. We started setting up the scenario there that Elisha, in his travels, because he would sort of run a circuit from one city to the next, preaching and teaching and ministering in the schools of the prophets. Well, his circuit often took him through this city of Shunem, which is here in the Jezreel Valley. It's on the side of the mountains there. Mount Carmel, where that doesn't look like anything, does it? Yeah. Looks like camouflage, yeah. Whoops. Why is that doing that? Ah, that's why. One setting wrong. All right, so here's Shunem in the Jezreel Valley, and Mount Carmel, we said this is the traditional site where Mount Carmel is at, where Elijah had his contest with the prophets. Could have been anywhere in this mountain range, really. But it's not all that far away from there, but Elisha would make a transit from Mount Carmel down to Gilgal, probably to Bethel and Jericho, where we know there were schools of the prophets. And as he was traveling, he stopped in this town called Shunem. And it says in chapter 4, verse 8, whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. There was this wealthy woman and her husband who would take him in and support him. They'd give him a meal and a place to stay. Well, he stops there so frequently that in verse 9, she says to her husband, "Behold, now I know that this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. Let us make a small room on the roof with walls, and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can go in there." They set him up his own quarters, his own wing in this house. It's on the roof. He has some privacy, but he has everything he needs there to rest and be able to do his ministry. He can write at the table. He has a lamp to see by, and it's going to take care of his needs when he's passing by. So, in the course of time, as he stops by there frequently, he decides that he needs to thank the woman for her patronage, and so he asks her what she would like to have in return. What do you want the Lord to do for you in return for the kindness that you showed me? And what was her answer? Yeah, she says, "I don't really need you to speak to the king for me. I dwell amongst my own people." What does she finally settle on? Well, she doesn't really settle on it. A son. She has no son, and her husband's old. Apparently she's not old, but her husband is. And so Elijah calls her in and says, "Hey, by this time next year, you're going to have a son." And what's her response? "Don't mess with me. Don't get my hopes up like this." She says, "Don't tease me with this kind of stuff. My heart's too set on that, and I don't want to have false hope." But we finish up in verse 17. The woman conceived. She bore a son about that time the following spring, as Elisha had said to her. So, does God care about average people? Does God care about the desires and the heart's desires of average people? Sure he does. Sure he does. And he has the power to accomplish those things that are in accordance with his will. Is there anything unbiblical about having children? Well, of course not. So it's not an unbiblical desire. It's not an unreasonable desire that she has. And anybody know another verse that talks about our desires when we seek the Lord? Okay, yeah, there is that verse that Jesus gives us, knock and it shall be opened to you, seek and you shall find. Yep. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. So God's blessings are multiplied when we search after him diligently and seek to obey his commands. What blessings is he talking about? Those normal lifetime blessings. Children are counted as a great blessing from the Lord. Well, I had one, and now I'm drawing a blank. What is it? It ends with, he shall give you the desires of your heart. I can't remember the first part of it, but hopefully you know where I'm talking about, Daniel. Oh, there is that one. Yeah, that's a different one. But mm-hmm. Well, so here God is displaying his great love and concern for this one family in the midst of all the thousands of families of Israel. But these are examples of people that are seeking him, that are being faithful to him, and what he's doing. So why might this be an important recording as far as the history of Israel? What does this have to do with the history of Israel? Hannah says nothing. Could be. I think it has a point. But why would God, for the sake of the nation, record these miracles to individuals? Right. So Israel, look at these people. I will bless you if you seek after me, like these individuals are. But you as a nation, you're not doing that. You're not searching after me. You're not seeking what I want. You're not striving to be obedient to my law and commandments. And so I haven't blessed you. Your nation's being attacked all over the place. Your crops are not as productive as they could be. The weather is kind of crazy. Wild animals are coming in. Strange events are taking place. But look at these people that I've had my hand on and use them as an example. They have sought me, they have done what I told them to do, and I am pouring out my blessing upon them. I'm taking care of them. I'll do the same for the whole nation, if you'll follow me. Well, she gets her son. But have you ever had a hope fulfilled like that, and then have it taken away? Because look at what happens in the next few verses. Verse 18, when the child had grown, so we're talking about some years later, not fully grown, as we're going to see from a couple of details in the narrative. He's not fully grown, but he's grown enough that one day he's out among the reapers and he says to his father, I just imagine this little boy bouncing around with daddy out in the field, right? But he says to his father, oh, my head, my head. So he's old enough to talk, but he's probably not full grown. So what might cause you to cry, my head, if you're out in the field? It's hot. Yeah, it's hot. So maybe he's out in the field and he's getting sunstroke or heat stroke or something. But whatever it is, it's not good. So his father says to his servant, carry him to his mother. This is where we say he's old enough to talk, but he's small enough to be carried. So he's not a full grown man yet, but he's a young boy. And when he had lifted him to and brought him to his mother, the child sat on her lap till noon, and then he died. Ugh. This is kind of mean of God, isn't it? I mean, give her the son that she's hoped for and then take him away? What do you think's going on? Growing your faith? Oh, yeah. This is going to be a big growth experience for this gal. The boy dies, and there's no doubt that he's died. He didn't faint, he didn't swoon, he didn't just pass out. He's dead. So she, verse 21, went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. What doesn't she do? Not yet. She doesn't ask him to heal him. She doesn't pray just yet. Okay, why? Go to her husband. Yeah, she doesn't go to her husband. In fact, look at the next verse, and what does it say? She called to her husband and said, ah, our son has died. Is that what she says? No, she says, send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may go quickly to the man of God and come back again. She doesn't even tell her husband that the boy died. Now, why do you think she took him up to the upper room and laid him down there? So the husband doesn't see him. Now, we could do all kinds of surmising and guessing as to why she doesn't want to tell her husband. But apparently she has a plan in mind. Where is she going? She's going to go to Elisha. Why do you think she's going to Elisha? She knows that the God Elisha serves, if that God gave me this son, then that God can restore him. Hebrews chapter 11. You go there to the hall of faith, and it starts talking about men like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Joshua. And you know who else gets mentioned there? It says women received their children raised back from the dead. Well, we know of two women that had their children raised back from the dead. Who was the first one? This woman's one of them. Who's the other one? Remember when Elijah went sojourning with the woman of... You know, people tell me that when I get older, my memory's going to go. And it scares me because it's already gone, right? So Elijah sojourned up here in Tyre. The Sidonian woman, that's it. The Sidonian woman who lived up here between Tyre and Sidon during the famine. And her son died, and Elijah restored him to life. And so here in Hebrews chapter 11, it explains to us what these women were thinking. They were faithful women. They understood that the God that gave them these children is the God that could restore them. And so she lays the child up in the bedroom of the prophet, probably a couple of reasons. Number one, she knows she's going to go get Elisha to see what he's going to do and see what God will accomplish through him. But what would the husband probably have done had he known the child was dead? Maybe stopped him from going. I heard someone else say it. Bury him. Because you don't let dead bodies lie around too long in the hot Israeli climate. You wrap them up, you bury them quickly. But here, she's protecting him from being buried. I think it is because she recognizes God's going to do something here. Maybe she doesn't know exactly what's going to happen, but she says, God's going to do something here. So she says to her husband, give me one of the servants, give me a donkey, I'm going to go see the man of God. He does have a question. He says, why will you go to him today? It's neither new moon or Sabbath. So apparently, there were gatherings that took place on those holy days of the new moon and the Sabbath day, and they would gather at the prophets' houses. And so we see this trend that the school of the prophets is sort of replacing the priesthood and the tabernacle in the lives of the people of northern Israel, because they can't go to the tabernacle anymore. They're not allowed to cross the border into the southern kingdom to visit the temple, and so they have to practice their faith in a little bit different of a way. And so we see this inclination or this indication that they are joining together for times of teaching, fellowship, much like we do here in our churches. And they would get together with the prophets to hear instruction. So he wonders why you're going to do that. It's not a church day, he says. And what's her answer? It's okay. Yeah, she doesn't give an answer, does she? It's okay. Everything's all right. Husband doesn't pry too much, probably figures she's just laid the young man down somewhere and he's resting, but she doesn't tell him what's happened. And she says, it's okay, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. We're joking around at the homeschool convention here with a couple other fathers about, sometimes us dads, we're oblivious people, right? It's moms usually know a lot more what's going on with things, but we dads, when we watch kids, we let them jump off of the pinnacles of houses with blankets to see if it'll work as a parachute. And, oh, yeah, that'll be fun, you know, let them climb ladders. And this guy is joking around. He says, God gave children mothers so that they would survive longer, right? I think that's true. We dads are like, yeah, sounds like an adventure. Let's have at it. But moms, they protect the kids. So yeah, here's a dad. He just figures, all right, the little boy's sleeping somewhere. I'll go back out to the field. And so he doesn't push too hard on what's going on here. So then she saddled the donkey and she said to her servant, urge the animal on. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. So in modern language, how would we say this? Put the pedal to the metal, Jeeves, All right? Don't spare the horses. So she gets her chauffeur who's going to walk and lead the donkey. She's going to ride the donkey. And she says, you know, move that animal. Get this thing going. We got to go quickly. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So right here is Shunem. Mount Carmel's up in this area somewhere. We're not really talking about all that long of a distance, especially if Carmel's not up here in the traditional site. So you somewhere between 15 and 25 miles she's going to travel, which on a donkey is a pretty reasonable distance to do in a day. So she goes quickly, and when the man of God saw her coming, which if he's up on top of a mountain, he'd be able to see for some distance, and so he sees somebody coming. He kind of recognizes who it is, and he says to Gehazi, his servant, look, there's the Shunammite. Run at once to meet her and say to her, is all well with you? So he recognizes this is a little out of the ordinary. Why is she coming to me? It's not a new moon. It's not a Sabbath day. It's not a church time, and so here she's coming. Something must be wrong. So Gehazi, go ask her. What's going on? And so Gehazi runs, and what's her answer to Gehazi? All's well. Everything's good. Oh, she's a liar, isn't she? Is everything good? No. Why does she not tell Gehazi what's going on? Well, there you go. She's confident that everything will turn out good. Okay. Yeah, I think she knows Elisha is the only one that can help with this. It's not Gehazi. Now, what else do we know about Gehazi? Think through your biblical readings. It's something that's going to occur in the following chapters, in fact, in chapter 5. But what do we know about Gehazi? Eldon. He does become a leper. Why does he become a leper? Exactly, yeah. Gehazi wants to profit a bit too much from the prophetic ministry, right? So he takes a gift from Naaman the Syrian. That's actually chapter 5, next chapter. So I don't know, maybe the people around kind of know the character of Gehazi a little more than the narrative has let on for us just yet. And so she says, I don't want to talk to you. I need to talk to Elisha, not you. At any rate, she knows Elisha is the one that's going to take care of this problem, so she doesn't want to take the time to stop and explain the whole situation to Gehazi, so she just says, all's well, keep moving, let's get up to the top of the mountain. And Gehazi, where am I here? Verse 27. When she came to the mountain to the man of God, she caught hold of his feet. And the Gehazi came to push her away. Why does he push her away? Okay, so it's like the disciples trying to shoo away the children. He's too important to be bothered with this. Partly. Not necessarily attacking, but this is kind of an indiscreet way to approach somebody to grab a hold of his feet. He's trying to protect Elisha's dignity, right? She's being very, very inglorious, I guess is the word. If this isn't proper protocol, you don't just grab a hold of somebody's feet. And so he goes to push her away, but Elisha recognizes something and he says, leave her alone. She's in bitter distress and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. This is one of those texts that gives us a little bit of insight into the prophets, because sometimes we wonder, this word of the Lord that came to them, you know, when it says very often the word of the Lord came to a prophet, what was that like? Could they do it whenever they wanted? Is it just a gift they had they could exercise any time? But this lets us know probably not. They were completely at the mercy of the Spirit of God when he would reveal things to them. And God doesn't tell Elisha what's going on here for some reason. I think probably God has a lesson for Elisha too. You're going to trust me. You're going to follow the plan, even though you don't know the outcome. Because, folks, does God always tell us the outcome of the plan? This might be a little bit of a trick question. Does God tell us the outcome of the plan?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
He doesn't tell us the exact outcome, but that it will grow.
Okay, so he does tell us the eternal outcome, right? We're going to grow from this. Our faith's going to be purified. But does he tell us what the situation's going to turn into? Almost never. Almost never. You know, I know I use this as a, as an example, and I hope I don't overdo it, but I hope it'll be an encouragement to you too, that when we found out we were pregnant with Joshy, it was months and months of turmoil in our hearts because we've lost 10. And so every night, laying awake there wondering, is God going to do the same thing again? Because boy, you know, I say God whatever you will, but sometimes I don't mean it because I don't want to lose another one. But we stay up praying and asking the Lord to set our heart in the right place and say, okay, Lord, if it's your will that we lose another one, then help us rest in that and rest that it's okay. But you don't know how it's going to turn out. And for 9 months, we didn't know how it was going to turn out. And even for, you know, a month or so after Joshy was born, we were still a little angst about whether or not he's okay, especially with all the stuff that happened around his birth. But God does that to us. He leads us through paths where we can't see what's happening because he wants us to just trust him and take one more step according to his word. And so Elisha doesn't know exactly what's going to happen, and he says, God hasn't told me. So verse 28, then she said, did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, do not deceive me? So she is, of course, upset. And we can all understand why she's upset, right? Okay. She's in turmoil here. And he said to Gehazi, that's Elisha, says to Gehazi, tie up your garment, take my staff in your hand, and go. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not reply. And lay my staff on the face of the child. Why the staff? Because it's not Elisha. It's the magical staff, right? It has talisman-like powers. Why the staff? Pete? He's hoping that God might work through the staff, right? Any other times when God used an inanimate object to perform a miracle?
Aaron's staff.
Right? All right, to decide the priest, it budded. Eldon?
Jesus used clay,
wiped it on the guy's eyes, right? Well, isn't that an interesting story where the Son of God doesn't immediately heal? He heals through a process. Why do you think that happened? Sometimes he heals through the process, right? Sometimes it's miraculous, sometimes he heals through the process, but is it always God who heals? So if I take my kid to the doctor because he broke his arm and they set the bone and it heals up and he's okay after that, did God do that or did the doctor do that? Yeah, God works through the doctors. Okay. Abby.
The bronze serpent,
right. Look at it and you'll be healed from your snake bite. Very good.
Rock.
The rock, what did the rock do?
Water.
Right. Rock shot out water after Moses did what? Hit it with a staff. How did Elisha pass through the Jordan River?
He slapped it with
Elijah's mantle. So often God did perform his miracles through the vehicle of some inanimate object. And so Elijah is probably thinking along those terms here. So Gehazi, get down there. Why does he tell him not to greet anybody?
Get there quickly.
All right, so in our society, you see somebody that you know when you're walking along the mall, how long does it take you to say hi?
2 seconds.
Depends on how well you know them, right? Okay. In this culture, you meet anybody along the road, and it's a long ordeal to greet them, ask them how they're doing, how their family is. It takes a lot of time. Guess what it would have been perceived as if Gehazi just went running by somebody without saying hi? Very rude. But it's an urgent matter. Jesus does the same thing to the disciples, by the way. And he tells them, you know, don't take a staff for your journey when they're going throughout the cities of Israel. Don't take a staff. Don't greet anybody along the way because the mission was urgent. So Gehazi has to run back to Shunem. Don't greet anybody along the way and lay the staff on the boy's face. Why tie up your garment? What's that all about? So it doesn't trip you. Right. So they didn't wear pants like we do. They wore a long robe. And if you were going to run, it would be awfully hard to run. Our ladies can probably tell us how hard is it to run in your dresses. Right? Not too easy. And so they would take the robe and they would wrap it around their waist and they would kind of tuck it into itself and tie it. And that would leave their legs free to run. So that's the imagery, by the way, behind the phrasing in the Bible, gird up your loins. It's wrap that thing around you and get ready for action. So he does. If anyone greets you, do not reply. Lay my staff on the face of the child. Verse 30. Then the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. How come she doesn't want to go with Gehazi?
She knows his character.
Maybe she knows his character. Okay. Maybe she wouldn't be able to keep up with him. Okay, he's going to run. So she's going to stick with Elisha. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I think there's something going on here too, that she knows that staff thing's not going to work this time. Don't know that? Just guessing. But she says, I'm going to stick with you because I know whatever God's going to do, he's going to work through you, and I want to be there when it happens. I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead, laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was no sound or sign of life. Therefore, he returned to meet him and told him, the child has not awakened. So laying the staff on the face of the child doesn't do anything. Why not? What's this telling us? What could potentially be communicated if the staff had healed the boy? That what? That Gehazi could do it? Possibly. That the staff did it. Right. So God doesn't want us to trust the thing that he works through. Whether it's the person or whether it's the staff, it's not the staff. It's God at work. And so I think God does this on purpose just so that we'll learn it's not about the staff, people. So when that TV preacher says, you know, just send in $500 towards my new plane and I'll send you this cloth that I prayed over, don't do it. Because it's not about the thing, is it? And by the way, if that guy's asking you for that much money to buy a plane, you probably just need to not listen to him anyway. So join us for our next congregational business meeting when we'll talk about the new limousine we're going to buy for the ministry here. Just kidding. Just kidding. Okay, it's not about the staff. Verse 32, when Elijah came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went in and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. Here's the key. Who's Elijah trusting to do this? God. It's not the staff. It's not the process. It's the God who might work through the process or might work through the staff, but it is God who's going to accomplish it. And so he prays about it. And then he went up and lay on the child, putting his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself upon him, and the flesh of the child became warm. You would expect this. Elijah's probably pretty warm from walking 20 miles. And so some of that heat transfers. Is that what's going to heal the boy? No. No, not at all. Because he doesn't come back to life at this point. And so Elijah has to get up, or Elisha, I keep switching names there. Elisha gets up again, verse 35, and walked once back and forth in the house, and went up and stretched himself upon him again. All right, so how many nights have you spent pacing back and forth, praying that God would accomplish something? It's like that, isn't it? When there's something very desperate going on in our lives, there are times you can't sleep. There are times you don't feel like you can eat. You're just consumed with this problem. And the only thing you can do is pace back and forth and just, Lord, what are you going to do? Please do something. And that sense of worry is always a motivation for us not to continue in worry, but to do what? Pray about it. All right, I'm going to cast all my care upon him because he cares for me. I'm going to be anxious for nothing, but in all things through prayer and supplication. So rather, every time I start sensing this building worry in my heart, that's an indication that I need to get on my knees again and pray. And that's what Elisha is doing. He got up again, walked once back and forth in the house, went up, stretched himself upon him, and the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. I'll be honest, I don't know what the sneezing's about. It just happened. Doesn't explain any significance of it for us. But that's what happened. He sneezes 7 times. It's also a good indication that somebody's alive, by the way. Eldon, you've died and then sneezed 7 times? You've sneezed 7 times. Leaves you a little tired, doesn't it? Obviously, he's now alive. He opens his eyes, and then he summoned Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. So he called her. And when she came to him, he said, pick up your son. And she came, fell at his feet, bowing to the ground, and she picked up her son and went out. And I'll bet you she went out of there with a much greater faith than the last time she was in that room. A faith in a God who is able to accomplish things like that. Because if he's the God that gave life to that child in the beginning, then he's the God that can restore life when something like this happens. So, does God care about individuals? Oh yeah. He's not just concerned about the events of nations. He cares about you. He cares about the little details of your life. He cares about the things that are troubling you. He cares about the things that are stressing you, the things that are worrying you, the things that are straining you. And he wants you to bring those to him and cast every care upon him. Any questions about what we've got that far?